Yeah, sustainability goes back to our first shack. Back in the early days, 2005, 2006, when I started getting involved with Shake Shack and started to understand our ingredients, you know, we wanted to understand like what was really important to us and to our guests. And, you know, again, coming from that fine dining background, the source of our ingredients was always important. Over the years, I've utilized the NRA Supply Chain Executive Exchange meetings and leveraged the relationships that I've built out of that to help design and build my supply chain. Building the marketing and the idea into the sourcing and the sourcing into the idea up front makes it so much easier for both supply chain and the marketing team to work together and roll out a product together.
Welcome to Farm to Fork, the Innovators. I'm your host, David Maloney, president of DataMFS, and I spent over four decades navigating the twists and turns of the food supply chain. On this podcast, we're diving deep into the stories and strategies that are reshaping the way we produce, distribute, and serve our food. Our guest innovator today is Jeff Amascato, Senior Vice President, Supply Chain and Menu Innovation at Shake Shack. With nearly two decades dedicated to Shake Shack and Union Square Hospitality Group, Jeff has played a pivotal role in establishing and expanding the company's supply chain network. During our discussion, we'll delve deep into several pivotal topics, including Jeff's culinary background and its impact on Shake Shack's supply chain operations and procedures, understanding Shake Shack as an entity, including its mission and the driving forces behind its success, analyzing Shake Shack's global expansion strategy while maintaining fidelity to its core mission, and Jeff's insights into the strategies behind Shake Shack's flourishing supply chain, including being an incubator for sustainability innovation. So buckle up, hit that subscribe button, and let's harvest progress together. This is Farm to Fork, the Innovators, where the future of the food supply chain starts with this episode. All right, Jeff, welcome to the show, and tell us about yourself.
I'm Jeff Amascato. I'm the Senior Vice President of Supply Chain and Menu Innovation at Shake Shack. And I've been in supply chain for about 18 years, but long before that, I was really in culinary. So supply chain is probably a newer part of my career.
Cool. And so any particular hobbies, anything like besides, I mean, you're a chef, besides cooking?
Well, I never call myself a chef.
Okay.
I went to culinary school. I have a culinary degree. I cooked in kitchens, but I never helmed the kitchen as the chef. So to me, coming from classical training, I just never like to be called a chef, but you know, definitely have all the culinary chops to go along with it. And because I don't need to be a cook every single day, I think one of my favorite hobbies is actually cooking.
Yeah.
Coming home, cooking dinner, cooking on the weekends, you know, give me a knife, give me some fire and a basket of food. And I just love to cook. So yeah. I don't need to make a daily profession out of it anymore. The ability to just continue my passion of food and flavors and creativity, I would call that one of my favorite hobbies.
Cool. A glass of wine doesn't hurt while you're cooking.
Yeah. That makes it easier too when you're not on the job. You can have a glass of wine from beginning to end. My favorite, and we might get into this in a little bit. We talked about Italy, but my favorite is cooking risotto.
Yeah.
It's a dish I learned to cook. One of the first dishes I learned to cook and a dish I learned to perfect working in Italy. And it's all over the place. Depends on the season, depends on the weather. You know, can you turn on the big green egg or are you going to, you know, saute inside because it's, you know, rainy and gross outside?
When did you first get interested in the restaurant business, even before culinary school, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in a family in New Jersey. I have a great aunt who had a cooking store in school in New Jersey. One of those kind of like schools where people could go to at night to have like a class on a certain type of item, whether it's making pasta or braising meats, really for the home cook. And I started taking classes, I think, as early as maybe 6 or 7. Like one of the first things is like kids that they had is like making these little peanut butter free cookies that we made. And, you know, I just was like always drawn to food growing up in an Italian family in New Jersey. And, you know, just cooking was always part of your everyday life, you know, holidays. Everybody gravitated towards the kitchen. You could set up any place else in the house, but everybody always ends up in the kitchen. And,
sure,
you know, it's all about the food and bringing the whole family together. So, you know, food was just always there. And I just always liked eating. I remember like my 10th birthday, my parents took me to a fine dining restaurant in the area of New Jersey that we're in. And I just always remember that as, you know, one of those first experiences of a restaurant. And most recently, this past summer, I got to do that to my oldest son who turned 10. So I brought him to Ci Siamo, one of our Italian, one of Union Square Hospitality Group's Italian restaurants in the city, and, you know, got to share that experience with him, and, you know, to just see like his smile on his face, you know, for having that experience. That's what restaurants do, is we put smiles on people's faces.
Yeah.
So kind of like fast forward a little bit through high school, I kind of like knew pretty early on, like that's what I wanted to do, was go to culinary school. It was right at that time where like the Food Network was just starting to take off. Anthony Bourdain's book came out, I think, my senior year or just when I started culinary school. So it was like right kind of at that point before it like really exploded into the Food Network that it is. But, you know, it was enough of awareness where, you know, culinary schools were starting to be considered a more viable option and not like the fallback, like vocational kind of place that you might go to if you didn't go to a traditional college. So I ended up going to New England Culinary Institute up in Burlington, Vermont. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, but some really good graduates did come out of there and went up there, you know, looked at both, you know, other schools, but, you know, just felt in love kind of with that Vermont area. And, you know, maybe skiing was close by and that may have drawn me up there too, but really it was a really good culinary school that opened up a lot of doors to me.
So you mentioned Anthony Bourdain. I mean, who were your mentors kind of, or even during that process and even today?
I mean, I look back at some of the kitchens that I worked in and different sous chefs that I had worked for, you know, they're mentors and they, the type of people will push you to be better every single day. And, you know, once you start, you get that ingrained in you, that culinary mentality, it's like you just walk faster, you do things with more of a purpose, you do things with more of a precision. And it just gets ingrained at such a young age that you don't lose it. Years later, I still have that, like, that drive every single day. And it's like walking into the kitchen and you know you got to get all your prep done before service, and then service comes and you got to get through service, and you kind of bring that, you know, kind of physicality to supply chain now, and it works.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone away. I can't get rid of it.
Yeah. So right along those lines. So that physicality, and that, I've never heard supply chain referred to that way, but it completely makes sense to me. At least it feels like a physical endeavor all day long, right?
It's both a sprint and a marathon.
Yeah.
Right? Like you have to get through the day. You got to get certain things done, but you got that long-term view you got to look out in front of you and make sure you're setting up for. So it's a balance of both ends. That sprint in the beginning of the day is always fun to catch up on.
Yeah. So and I love that view, how you talk about that. How, besides kind of bringing that physicality, as you put it, to the supply chain, how else is your culinary degree? And folks, one of the reasons I wanted to, you know, Jeff to be on the show is Jeff doesn't have your traditional supply chain entry. And I think it's really interesting. I'm always fascinated by the industry has a mixture of business people and artists and kind of people who are molded in kind of both. And it's just a fascinating, like the people are awesome in this industry. I really love Jeff's background and how he approaches things. And I think he can pick that up right while he's talking about the sprint and looking at it from the long-term view of the supply chain. But besides the physicality, how is your culinary degree or training prepared you for the supply chain?
Well, I think the deep understanding of food and wanting and the desire to know where food comes from, you know, really helps in my role, supply chain and the menu innovation part. I mean, I am responsible for culinary, I'm responsible for supply chain, I'm responsible for QA, and I need to bring all of those together. And, you know, the culinary part of me wants to deeply understand those ingredients and where we're sourcing them from, who we're buying them from, what's happening, whether it's on the ranch or on the farm or in the manufacturing plant that's making the food. I mean, it's just, it's a constant questioning of why and how it's being done. And I think if you just look at it from numbers and spreadsheets, you lose out on the passionate part of it. It becomes a widget instead of, you know, a living, breathing thing that ultimately turns into what we were talking about before, putting a smile on somebody's face.
Yeah. Is it fair to say if, as we turn things into widgets, as we have a tendency to do as an industry, we lose some of the opportunity of the customer experience?
Yeah. I mean, everything is about the guest experience at the end of the day. I mean, who are we here to serve is the guest, and to give them whatever brand it is, their best version of what their product is. And for us, it's the best burgers, the best fries, and the best shakes. And, you know, along that, the hospitality to deliver it.
Yeah. And so besides your culinary degree, you also, if I remember correctly, were in operations.
Yeah, I did a brief stint in operations.
Yeah.
I think I learned the front of house and learned that that wasn't the best place for me. I liked it. I had fun. I think table side service, wine service, all that is fun, but it just wasn't, I knew it wasn't for me and for what I wanted to make my career out of, but it gave me the right perspective of the guest interaction and being on the guest side and what it's like to have to interact with many, many guests day in, day out, and the requests that come from them. And particularly in a busy fine dining restaurant that I was in at that time, you know, it's a very athletic position as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the communication back into the kitchen, you know, you play an important role of kind of like, almost referee is not the right word, but like intermediary between what's happening in the front and what the kitchen needs to get done.
We developed our soft skills, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And before we kind of jump into Shake Shack here, Jeff did an apprenticeship in Italy. Is it Imola? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Imola.
Okay, Imola.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Like, so, well, I guess you're Italian, so Italy makes sense, right? I mean, I am too. I love it there. But, you know, why Italy? What did you learn? And then what do you want to forget?
I don't know if there's anything I want to forget, but
okay.
So going back to opening doors, I mean, when I was at Newland Culinary Institute and the doors that were open for me there, my first internship I did there, I was at Le Cirque 2000 in New York City, you know, fine dining restaurant, you know, one of the best at the time. And I, you know, had met a cook there that also went to the same school that I went to. He had done this apprenticeship over in Italy. He's like, you should go check it out. So it wasn't an interview, basically called up. I'm like, you want free labor? I could be there for this many months. Here I come. And was able to go over to San Domenico in Imola, which is about 20 kilometers southeast of Bologna. So in the Emilia-Romagna region, you know, the breadbasket of Italy. And did an apprenticeship there. It was a 2 Michelin star restaurant. I lived, they had like rooms above the restaurant.
Oh, cool.
And you basically worked 2 services a day. You got up in the morning, you went downstairs, you prepped for lunch, you did lunch, you had your afternoon kind of like siesta. You came back, dinner service started at 8, went till 10. It was basically one seating. There was like, I don't know, 50 seats in the restaurant, but each seat, you have to understand, like each seat got 8 to 10 courses.
Yep.
So like you're doing 400 to 500 dishes out of this kitchen a night for 50 guests. And I mean, you lived upstairs and you came down. I got 150 euros a month as a stipend, and got to, experience the culture and eat around. And I mean, there's nothing I want to forget. And, I have a notebook that I had kept while I was over there. And every once in a while, I could, like, open it up and see some of the memories that I, wrote down. So it's more about, like, remembering what I did than forgetting anything there.
Yeah.
Some good recipes too, I came back with.
I think that the dining experience in Italy is just the best. It's just the best. It's slow. It's methodical. It's to be savored.
Thoughtful and intentional.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's just the best. Just the best. All right, cool. And so you got involved with Union Square Hospitality Group, right? How did that happen? Or were you there? You went and did your apprenticeship and then?
Yeah. So after I came back from Italy, I ended up landing at Jean Georges in New York City. And I cooked there as a line cook. And, while I was there, I realized I'm a good cook. I could be a really good line cook. I can hold my own in that environment, learned a lot. But I'm not sure when I'm 40, I want to be a cook behind a stove. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go back and get my food and beverage management degree from New England Culinary Institute again, which then got me more focused on that front of house world. And unfortunately, when I look back, I think a disservice that many culinary schools do, and that one did at the time too, is they didn't open your eyes to the world of, like, supply chain and other parts of the restaurant business. It was your back of house or your front of house. And, like, those are your two paths.
Yeah.
And to find your path into supply chain or CPG or any other aspect of food wasn't very clear in a traditional culinary school world. So I ended up going to school for food and beverage management. I landed at Union Square Hospitality Group as an intern opening the Restaurants and Museum of Modern Art in September 2004.
Yep.
So,
been there.
Excellent restaurant.
Yep.
Awesome to see. I was able to walk around the museum at that time before it was open. It was going through this, like, massive multi-year renovation. So it shut down, huge expansion renovation, and we got in there a few months before it reopened to the public, and to be able to, like, walk through the halls and see, like, paintings sitting on the, like, on the floor leaning up against the wall before they were hung, and just, like, getting, like, that whole back end view of the museum was really remarkable at the time.
Cool. So I
landed there, and that's where I did the front of house work for a while, and again, realizing, like, that wasn't necessarily the place I wanted to end up, I was asked if I was interested in doing this purchasing role for the restaurants were there. So, like, Union Square Hospitality Group had four restaurants, four food service operations within the building, from fine dining to cafeterias to staff cafe for, employees. And, it's kind of like, running a hotel purchasing department. Like, you had a loading dock, you had multiple revenue centers, you're kind of, like, buying for a large central kitchen and then requisitioning out food and banquet orders. You had different events, you had your set menus. So it was, like, a wide ranging aspect of food coming in and, a large amount of food for quite a large operation. So I got into this role of purchasing, kind of because I didn't necessarily want to go back into the kitchen. I didn't want to be front of house, but I love the restaurant business and I love being involved with food. And this was a nice way of being involved with food and also starting to get into, like, the numbers and the financial operations and business of restaurants. So I did that for quite a few years, kind of, like, help organize and turn that department into an efficient operation. Mm-hmm. And it was one of many restaurants within the Union Square Hospitality Group in New York City at the time. So now we're talking, like, 2007, there's several restaurants all over the city that all fall under this umbrella, but nobody's kind of, like, working together. There's a corporate office downtown with a few people in it that have, like, centralized finance and HR functions, but there's no, like, purchasing or... Mm-hmm. I mean, supply chain wasn't a word at the time, but just purchasing. And you know, think about like simple things like a Coca-Cola contract or an Ecolab contract or your Seafold napkins and garbage liners. Like we're all just like buying from whoever. And you know, as you can imagine, New York City has a lot of distributors to choose from. So whatever chef was in there or GM was in a restaurant, it's whoever they had always used. So there was like no continuity across anything. And it kind of dawned on me. I'm like, why don't I reach out to Randy Garuti, who was the director of operations at the time and is now our CEO of Shake Shack, soon to retire CEO of Shake Shack. And I kind of reached out to him and said, like, you know, we have all these restaurants, you know, is there something we should do together? And he was like working on a Coca-Cola contract, I think, at the time to try to get us all on the same price because you had 8 restaurants buying Coke at a different price and just happened to have an opening at the corporate office to kind of like start that up and handle some other operational things for the restaurants. And then that's when, oh, by the way, there's this little burger brand called Shake Shack that's also in the portfolio. So
Never heard of it, Jeff.
I mean, it Shake Shack opened in June of 2004. I joined MoMA, the Modern, in September 2004. You know, had a burger there sometime that summer and a few times, but never did it cross my mind, like, I'm going to go work for this little kiosk in Madison Square Park and make a career out of, you know, sourcing the best burger meat and buns and bacon that there could possibly be. So it's just wild kind of like set of luck circumstances and just landing in the right place.
Yeah, cool. So Shake Shack, if there's anybody out there, just in case, who doesn't know who Shake Shack is, who is Shake Shack? What's the brand? What's the mission?
Yeah, so we're a modern roadside burger stand. Our mission is to stand for something good. You know, we serve the guests that we have in the communities that we're in, you know, the best food and product we possibly can. We're born out of Union Square Hospitality Group. You know, Danny Meyer's 5 Tenets of Enlightened Hospitality, you know, turns into our stand for something good mission. And, you know, that's really to source the best ingredients, take care of our team members, take care of our guests, be a great community gathering spot, and have a lot of fun along the way. So right now there's 525 Shake Shacks globally.
Wow.
So there's no excuse to not know who we are. About 338 in the US and 187 international. And we're in 17 countries globally with 2 more coming up. We'll be opening Canada and Malaysia this year. So no excuse for anybody that's out there that hasn't heard of us or eaten at a shack. I think also important to note, like in the US, you know, everything street side that you go to is all corporate owned and operated locations. And then if you go to a airport, stadium, roadway, or on like New Jersey Turnpike, the New York Thruway, I started expanding that arena. We have licensed partners for that expansion. But baseball season's coming up and we have several stadiums out there that you can find us in.
Cool. So excuse my ignorance here, but at Union Square Hospitality Group, most of the rest of the restaurants are more higher end. Is that fair?
Yes.
From a menu price standpoint, right? And here you have this pivot into, you called it a kiosk?
The first one in Madison Square Park is a little 400 square foot kiosk.
Right.
No indoor dining.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of us would view maybe a higher menu price restaurant versus a fast casual QSR. How would we categorize Shake Shack?
Fast casual.
Fast casual. Okay.
Yeah.
As two different, completely different operations, right? And typically, and maybe this is probably my ignorance, it would be kind of hard. You would develop that skill set in one or the other, and it would be hard to go back and forth. But somehow, you all have done it magically. So what's the secret?
I mean, our DNA and our roots are in fine dining.
Yep.
Several of us, you know, starting with Randy, our CEO, myself, some of our heads of operations, our executive chef, we all come from Union Square Hospitality Group in one way or another. So we have this like rooted connection to that fine dining world, but we've all surrounded ourselves with really amazing people as we've grown to help balance that out with the skill sets that are needed to build a growing chain. But we have that connection back to what it means to be fine dining, what it means to source the best ingredients, and that doesn't go away from you. So it becomes, how do I scale this and buy more of whatever it is while maintaining that same excellence that you would expect every day coming in the back door of a one-off restaurant that has a white tablecloth in the front of house and is serving 100 guests in a night.
So is it fair to say that you all have brought almost a fresh, innovative, I don't want to say that other fast casual restaurants don't have the same principles and aren't trying to do, right? Because a lot of them are, but you all have had a training probably at a different level than a lot of people in this industry have had. And would you say that's part of the secret to your all's success?
I think that's part of it. I think, you know, we, along with others, and I wouldn't say we're the only ones out there, but we, along with others, have elevated the industry and elevated the expectation of quality coming from the supplier network and distributor network. So I think we're one of several that have pushed others to be better and be the ones that are at the forefront of making that happen. So I don't think we're out and not on an island doing it ourselves, but we're kind of like leading the way, forging the path, and others are coming along and helping make that a larger path for everybody.
Yeah, that's great. That's well said. That's well said. Now, in a prior episode, we were talking offline that Jeff was enjoying the Mike Halen episode. Mike talks about one of the things that he really looks for in companies is, are they promoting or within and are employees staying? Sounds like a lot of your team, right? A lot of the people there in the C-suite, executives, et cetera, have been there a long time. Is that fair?
Yeah, I just coincidentally added up the tenure of my team the other day, just because I happened to be on some spreadsheet and looked at it. And on my team alone, I have 100 years of Shack experience.
Wow.
Just on my team.
So that's supply chain, menu innovation, and QA.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome.
And you think about, like, it's awesome to say that. It shows the tenure of the team around you, the dedication of the people that you work with. And I have many dedicated team members of my own. And this is just my team. I'm not even thinking, you know, talking to other teams, but a lot of other teams probably can add up to even, you know, a higher number of tenure. But, you know, my team is really rallied around myself and what we're doing to grow this brand. And, you know, I think that's what also sets us apart is once you start getting that tenure and the people staying, they understand and they breathe it and they speak it better than anybody else can. And it just, it's like self-feeding in a way.
Compounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. So how is Shake Shack's supply chain similar? And then maybe would you say is unique versus other restaurant supply chains? And I know you haven't really done supply chain anywhere else, but just in kind of, you know, maybe in your ventures with making connections through the industry, et cetera.
Well, I think we're similar in the sense of over the years, I've utilized the NRA Supply Chain Executive Exchange meetings and leveraged the relationships that I've built out of that to help design and build my supply chain. So I think some basic structures of how we're set up are similar, but then I think we're uniquely different in that, one, I report to the CMO,
really,
which I think is very unique in the world of supply chain, right? I mean, I bet you haven't heard that one too many times.
I love it.
The reason for that is really because of the culinary part of my responsibility and the culinary-led part of our business. So we marry together early in the process, at the very beginning, the pieces of marketing, of guest insights, of analytics of our guests, and build that all together with the creation of the food that we're doing and the sourcing, and building the sourcing story into the actual creation of the menu items right along with marketing. So just instead of working in silos and so separate, and marketing coming up with an idea and supply chain having to go out and fulfill it and might not have the passion behind it, we're there from the start and the ideation all the way through to the execution together.
Okay, I want to stay here for a minute because I think this is incredibly important. So CMO, Chief Marketing Officer, just in case anybody doesn't know what that is. Okay. A lot of times my experience is that marketing in the industry, marketing and supply chain have a tendency, there can be some, and you probably may not know this because you didn't work anybody, but there's a tendency to be some friction.
I've seen that on stages as people talk about the challenges.
Yeah. Okay. Seems to be. But you report to the chief marketing officer, which you're exactly right. Never heard where supply chain reported the chief marketing officer. And I know you just kind of walked us through that, but can you do that again? Why? Because I think it's so important. I think the industry, one of the challenges for supply chain, particularly in the past, I believe it's getting better, is that supply chain has been measured by cost. How am I doing versus last year? How am I doing? What kind of food cost are we running, et cetera, right? And I'm not saying that's not important. It's incredibly important.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you know this. I own a restaurant in downtown Sarasota.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, it's incredibly important. Otherwise, you're out of business, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, typically supply chain will report in to finance, right, to a CFO. What's the thought process again on the chief market? And I know you talked about, but I think this is so important. I think we want to kind of hear it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Building the marketing and the idea into the sourcing and the sourcing into the idea up front makes it so much easier for both supply chain and the marketing team to work together and roll out a product together. You know, when we think about, as we're developing menu items, what is the story that we're going to tell? What's going to make it different for our guests? Why should they come to Shake Shack and get this? And when you plan that and ideate that together up front, instead of getting a black and white spec sheet sourcing document that says, I need XYZ, that has no emotion. But when you're there together and bring that emotion of the brand to the quality and the sourcing and the standards of the product, it just makes for a better possibility of a positive outcome when you bring it to market, and it feels more authentic.
Yeah. I think that this just makes complete sense to me. This just makes, like, given all of your backgrounds, right, in culinary, and then the importance of the story and the why and the ingredients, which you kind of kicked off with, right? And how important that is. Guess what? Consumers love that.
Exactly.
Right? Like, I'm getting excited right now. Like, okay, we're going to Shake Shack, right? Like, I'm getting excited, right? I mean, food with a story. When I think about the food, and you alluded to this earlier, but I think we're all incredibly privileged to work in this business because food is one of the most intimate things, one of the holiest things we do as a society, right? And I think we owe it to ourselves sometimes not to take that for granted. And what I hear you all saying is we're not taking that for granted.
Definitely not. We see the value in how it brings everything together to that first bite that you get to take, and all the way through to that last sip of the shake. You know, it all that work together up front, just it marries it so perfectly.
That's awesome.
I'm afraid I'm having a bunch of supply chain people running around afraid that they're going to report to a CMO now.
What keeps your supply chain up at night?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's like huge things that keep us up at night. you know, there's always your commodity pressures. Like right now, obviously, what's happening in beef is challenging. And sure, I think I could say that that keeps me up at night, and different distribution challenges that one might have. But I think, I don't know if this, I would say it keeps me up at night, but what is always top of mind is how do we continue to scale and maintain the excellence and quality that we've had up to this point. You know, again, while we're big, we're still really small. We're really tiny and have a lot of opportunity to grow a whole lot more than where we are today. So how do we build that ingredient pipeline and that supplier pipeline to be able to have the same quality experience when we're at Shake Shack 1000 that it is when we're at today's 525. So I think that's, you know, definitely the thing that is most top of mind versus necessarily keeping me up at night, but most top of mind and, you know, an area that we're, you know, laser focused on growing and improving our supply base to support that.
How do you stay true to how you are? Is that fair?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you stay authentic?
Yeah, I think we're fortunate in that we're growing at a comfortable pace. We're not, you know, ripping 100 shacks open a year or 200 and, you know, flying through openings. We're at a steady pace in the U.S. at 40 to 45 locations, which is comfortable in that, you know, we can maintain and build the supply chain, the quality, the employees, everything that you need to open a quality restaurant every single time. But as a menu and kind of like how we're growing and building on the menu is, you know, we're really, obviously we're focused on, you know, our core of burgers, chicken, fries, custard. And we continue to look to build and develop flavors on those, looking at what our international partners are doing. So like we have our Korean style fried chicken or Korean style burger on the menu right now. And, you know, looking at what our partners in South Korea are doing and the flavor profiles that they have,
interesting,
you know, available to them. You know, we're looking back at a few things that kind of fell away from us during COVID. We removed concretes from our menu during COVID. And if you don't know what concretes are, it's our premium custard that we put mix-ins, you know, some like sauces and mix-ins, and we blend them together. So we had to take that away. And now we're playing around and reintroducing our version of a sundae that we're testing at a few locations. And I'm really excited about back on the menu. We want to be a place, I got three little kids. I want us to be the place where after a little league game or a soccer game or whatever, we're going to go get, you know, a shake, or we're going to get a sundae or a scoop of custard with the whole team. And, you know, again, going back to like, we're a community gathering spot and having those types of items available where kids, young and adults and grandparents and everybody in between can come together and enjoy a meal, that's the best place to be. Yeah, another area we continue to look at, I don't know if you know, but you know, we have beer and wine on our menu. That is not, you know, common for, you know, fast casual or QSRs, and have recently kind of like revamped our beer and wine. We have a wine that's made for us, Sauvignon Blanc, a rosé, and a Cabernet. They're in can, so there's a sustainability aspect to it, you know, versus being in a glass bottle, more of like a single serve can.
Yeah.
We have our own beer that's made for us by Brooklyn Brewery, our Schachtmeister Ale that we've had for probably 15 plus years. And then, you know, work with local breweries around the country that might be local to your neighborhood. So
very cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's awesome to be able to go and have a burger and a beer, except if you're in New Jersey like I am because of our liquor laws here. And I can't do that in my home state, but everywhere else you could have a burger and a beer.
Cool.
If you happen to be flying through the Denver airport, there's a full bar with a really awesome cocktail menu, kind of like based around some of our ingredients.
Cool. I'm going to go to Shake Shack maybe this weekend, although I gave up beer for Lent.
So you're close. You don't have another week.
Yeah, I'm very close. You're right. One more week, baby. One more week. So anyways, you mentioned a term earlier, and kind of where you're going. And so just for those who don't know kind of the process of this, I forwarded, as I do every guest, a framework of questions. I don't want to give exact questions ahead, about a week ahead of time. And Jeff came back to me and said, hey, look, I want to talk about sustainability, right? And this is important to us. So let's unpack that a little bit. First off, why is it important, right? And what are you doing?
Yeah, sustainability goes back to our first shack. Back in the early days, 2005, 2006, when I started getting involved with Shake Shack and started to understand our ingredients, you know, we wanted to understand like what was really important to us and to our guests. And, you know, again, coming from that fine dining background, the source of our ingredients was always important. Those restaurants that we were all part of would literally go to the Green Market in Union Square and get their produce and sometimes their proteins for dinner that night. Mm-hmm. So that was just like, again, ingrained in where we started and has carried through. So, you know, the proteins that we first started sourcing, we knew we wanted our beef, our chicken, our pork to be from sustainable sources or producers that are raising animals in a certain way. And that led us to certain suppliers around the country. And I got a really good supplier in the San Francisco area in Oakland, California, Creamco, who does our beef grinding for Northern California. But more importantly, he is an aggregator of regenerative meat in Northern California and for the Bay Area restaurants. We're one of many customers to him, and we're an outlet for certain cuts of a grass-fed, regeneratively raised Northern California cattle producer. But it also then gives the ability for him to sell the rest of that animal to other restaurants in the Bay Area. I mean, I'm not buying tenderloins and I'm not buying, strips. Mm-hmm. Somebody else is, but you have this entire carcass to utilize. So collectively, we all the restaurants play in that better sourcing.
Yep.
And make it viable for that small farmer, Richard's grass-fed beef, to be able to produce to a much different level of production. Doing things like that, we recently did this really cool test of 0-acre oil in New York in the fourth quarter of last year. It's a fryer oil. We did it in two of our locations that is made through the fermentation of sugarcane. So sugarcane, is a perennial wild grass that grows from natural rainfall. And they've created this way of making this, ultimately ending up with this fryer oil that the best thing I could say out of it is it tastes neutral. Like it's really good fryer oil and it tastes neutral.
Right.
And it has really good environmental outcomes from that production because of the reduction in land use and the reduction in water use. So we piloted that, trying to figure out next steps. Is it's a small company and obviously supply chain steps need to happen to scale it. But, those are kind of like sustainable things that, we're always looking at and trying. And that's the exciting part of the job.
Yeah.
To me. One of many exciting parts.
So can you define... before we define sustainability, I want to just reiterate something Jeff said about if we're talking about the cattle, right, and how important it is from my experience of working with manufacturers too, is that a lot of them really want to invest in sustainability. But one of the problems is particularly in cattle, they can only get value out of a certain part of the animal. They're bringing restaurants together to kind of solve this problem. And this is something that restaurants as a whole can't do on their own, that we have to all work together, I think, is collaborate on really to work. Is that fair?
That's fair. And the other thing I would say that really goes along with that is you need to take small steps first before you can take giant leaps with it.
Great point.
You can't do it overnight across 100, 200 locations. Yeah. You have to be willing, flexible, and nimble to do one or two or three or a small little region to get it going. And, you know, going back to what makes our supply chain unique is we're willing to do things like that and not just put ourselves in a position of it's all or nothing. That would eliminate the ability to play around and test and have fun and learn. And that's what you do with these smaller kind of productions that we'll work through.
I would assume that it's probably easier for you to do this because you all own all your stores as opposed to having a franchise model.
That certainly makes it a lot easier. And, you know, we do this just in the U.S. I mean, we localize production and ingredients globally, but these kind of like tests we'll do within our U.S. owned shacks.
Yeah. And just for the audience, does Shake Shack, or do you have a definition on sustainability, like, or a goal or anything around that?
That is a very loaded, long answer question that will take another 2 hours of a podcast. And that's the problem with the word sustainability or regenerative. It can mean a lot of things. For us, we're looking at what is best for the supplier, what's best for the land, the outcome of the land, what improves land use over time. And ultimately, there's a sustainability part to the business. Like, it has to work for our business. But I do not have a list of metrics and numbers that say this is what sustainability is, because then I think it gets challenging to accept different opportunities to look at, because then you're trying to fit sustainability into a box, and it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, no offense, but you're not the expert at everything.
Right.
And you've provided the platform, right, for innovators. You're essentially providing a network for these innovators to come to.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yeah, and we love it when new ideas or new processes or new ways of looking at an old item come to us. And that gets us excited to try it out and give it a chance. And going into it knowing that it doesn't have to always work at the end of the day, but if we gave it a really good shot and they got better because of us trying it out and we got better, and maybe it's something that we can implement beyond those locations, then we've all made progress forward.
Yeah. And so I have to believe there's going to be some suppliers on here that are going to say, we can do that, right? So how do you all have a process where how people can present things as they're, could you enlighten us on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it always, first of all, it's building the relationship with us and coming to us with an idea and a desire and enthusiasm. And sometimes it just takes planting the seed in a way. Mm-hmm. Plant the seed, plant the idea, let it kind of grow. And in the future, it could be an opportunity for us to get together. Having new suppliers come to us is awesome. Like, doors wide open for suppliers to come knocking and you know, seeing what the options are and possibilities. You know, while we're very like streamlined in what we offer in a way, you know, burgers, yeah, fries, shakes, you think like there's not a lot of opportunity in there. But the reality is there's a ton of opportunity because it's all the things, all the components, all the add-ons that, you know, make those final dishes fun and exciting. And, you know, having a supplier community that brings us those ideas and brings us new innovation ultimately serves our guests the best thing that they can get. And going back to what I said in the beginning, like, we just want to put smiles on faces.
Yeah. Great stuff. Great stuff. So, and congratulations. Very refreshing. Very refreshing, Jeff. Where do you want the supply chain to go?
Yeah, I think number one is I want the supply chain to become more and more transparent,
yeah,
for everybody involved. I mean, transparency just leads to better trust, better understanding, better visibility, better ability to innovate if we're all transparent with each other along the way. And then it leads to collaboration. And yeah, a lot of these words are standard commonality in supply chain, but you need that collaboration, you need those relationships, and all of that just leads to a better integrated, you know, supply chain, supplier, restaurant, distributor, whole community base together. And that's where I think it's going. And I see major, major improvements in that direction, and being able to work with all the different people in that whole system. It's the fun part, the creative part.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun. I agree with you. Let's lift each other up.
Yes.
Right? Let's rise together.
All boats rise with the tide.
That's right. All right, Jeff, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I want to thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, David, thank you. This was a lot of fun, and I'm enjoying listening to your podcast. So can't wait to hear more.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of another insightful journey through the fields of innovation on Farm to Fork, The Innovators. It's an honor to have you listen. If you found today's episode as fascinating as we did, don't forget to share it with a friend, write a review, and hit that subscribe button so you never miss another episode. Farm to Fork is not just a podcast. It's a community of forward thinkers and change makers. Your thoughts and ideas matter to us. Reach out on social media or through our website, datamfs.com, and be a part of the ongoing conversation. As we wrap up today, remember, the future of the food supply chain is in our hands. Stay curious, stay innovative, and let's continue growing together. Until next time, this is David Maloney, signing off from Farm to Fork, The Innovators. Thank you for being a part of this community. See you in the next episode.